Welcome to the Toncast. I'm your host, Francis Stokes, or as I often go by, Francin Dog. And our special guest this evening is Todd Robert Anderson, the actor from commercials. I believe he's in other stuff too. So welcome, Todd. Welcome to the
Thanks for Toncast. Having me. It's a great honor to be on your podcast.
Awesome. There's a lot that we can talk about, but in thinking about what I would have to say to Todd Anderson when I was get to actually interview him in person, since I know you, I'm very familiar with all of your output, and what's interesting about trying to figure out what to interview you about is that you're already so out there. I mean, you've talked extensively on your blogs and you've written extensively about what it's like, what your life is like as an actor in Hollywood and all that. So I decided instead what we would discuss is your taste.
My taste?
Yes, specifically your taste in movies.
In movies?
Yeah, I thought that would be an interesting topic to talk about because, I never totally got it. And so I thought we could discuss it. You're, first of all, for anybody who doesn't know, you're a huge fan of genre pictures, specifically like horror stuff,
action stuff.
Action stuff.
Sure.
Anything B movie.
I love B movies.
Right.
Yeah. Which don't really exist much anymore.
Right.
I guess now
straight
you would call
DVD
them straight to video.
Yeah. And you're really a connoisseur of that. And that's interesting in of itself to talk about. But I also want to talk about your attitude towards movies in general, where I think you are very generous towards a B-movie when it comes out, a movie like The Expendables or the prequel to The Thing and stuff. You're highly critical of anything created by Hollywood that is aspiring for something more. And that's what I think is kind of an interesting contrast.
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying.
You know, it's among our friends, we know you to be, for your crotchety tastes, kind of in movies, you know? I've joked with you and with our friends before that I know what movie I want to see, because if Todd doesn't like it, then I'll probably like it,
probably
you know?
Like it, yeah. I have that same thing with a number of people in my life, that if they say, oh, I love this, you have to see it, I avoid it like
you want. And that's a good policy. For you.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think of you as having maybe a contrarian taste.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, I'm coming to a place even this year with Rotten Tomatoes where I if it's above 90%, I probably won't see it. If it's between, you know, 60 and 89%, I'll check it out.
Then you think you might like it.
Yeah. And if it's the right genre and it's below 25%, then I'll check it out.
And you know you're going to like it.
Yeah.
And then which the thing, I'm pretty sure fell into that category.
Well, I just saw The Thing last night.
Okay.
I took my wife out to dinner and a movie. She loves horror
movies.
She's
a fan of that stuff
She is. She is. She's actually more forgiving of horror fare than I am.
Well, that doesn't surprise me because of your natural tendency to be critical.
it's true. Well, that's true. I'm a critical person, I think, innately, and then also if you watch as many movies as I do, then you can't help but see things, see flaws,
right,
and successes maybe that other people don't. But yeah, also my tastes are very strange. I mean, I thought The Thing prequel was, and it really that movie, I mean, you can call it a B movie, I guess, because it's a lower budgeted studio movie, but it's still a studio movie. It's a movie that tries to capitalize on the sort of cult popularity of John Carpenter's The Thing, which itself was a remake.
Right.
And this is a prequel to the remake, which is already convoluted and the waters are very muddy, just that concept alone. I mean, I thought they did some things okay. I mean, I thought, you know, the way they incorporated certain images from John Carpenter's The Thing and gave them a backstory was kind of okay. But the movie, you know, and I'm so wary about being critical of actors as individuals, the movie, I mean, one of the main problems I have with modern acting is it's so minimalist as to be bland. Like, what was once it's when you're in a casting session or on a set, even, you know, you'll get, can you just bring it down, just make it more real, make it, you know, do less. And it's because it's sort of across the board because of, you know, especially hour-long TV dramas, but even half-hour comedies are starting to get this way with the single-camera comedy. And then
commercials used to be such stylized.
Well, and when I started
getting... I never knew my hair could be this
when
clean,
I started getting into the commercial game, and this is 15 years ago,
right?
That was the main thing I heard. Make it more real. This director likes it if you don't do anything.
So that's been a while in commercials.
Yeah, yeah. It's been like that in commercials for a long time. And I've seen it bleed into all other forms of entertainment, because now where they pluck their directors and producers from in a lot of cases is commercials.
From commercials. Do you think it's an audience taste, or do you think it's really just an industry taste?
I think it's just an industry taste. I haven't thought about this before, but theoretically it kind of makes sense that it was born out of commercials, and there's so many people who are coming from commercials that's what they learned. And
actors,
that's what they're
too.
Regurgitating, all of them.
Yeah.
When you get told, now in commercials, I'm starting to hear, yeah, I know you've been hearing keep it real, but they don't want that. Mm-hmm. These people actually want you to go over the top. But in the theatrical world, in TV and film, the only place you ever hear that is if you're auditioning for a tweener show or a little kid show on the Disney Channel or Nickelodeon or whatever. But then it's the complete opposite.
Oh, it's incredibly
big. There's no subtlety at all to the performance. And I think there is such a thing as a middle ground. The thing, you know, at large, and I'm not saying that I think the actors are bad actors. That's not what I'm saying. But what uniformly in the cast of the Thing prequel, unlike the original Thing, is that everybody is so, their energy is the same. It's bland.
So they don't stand, nobody stands out.
Nobody stands out, and whereas...
Because the personalities in the original Thing were pretty great.
Yeah, John Carpenter's The Thing, yeah.
Would you mind untying me from this chair?
Yeah, and also, I mean, it's like, and that movie did it very simply. I mean, it's not, everybody in that, all the characters had specific jobs.
Right.
So in the first act, you understood what they were doing according to their jobs. And then their personalities started to come out of the situation.
I guess I can see a progression like that in a way that's interesting, because Aliens is like that.
Uh-huh.
But Avatar is not. Where all the characters are kind of... I can't really describe the difference between them.
That's what I'm saying.
Except one's Latina, one's not.
And when you have... And they, you know, the Thing prequel is... kind of sticks with the John Carpenter formula of his version of the Thing, in that, you know, there's a lot of those story beats happen. But in John Carpenter's The Thing, there's a big, you know, scene where basically, you know, half the cast is suddenly killed
right.
in a horrible way. But when that's happening, and it's madness. But when that's happening in John Carpenter's The Thing, you know exactly who just died.
Right.
You know, the doctor just got his arms torn off, and the stoner guy just, this happened to him, and you know.
Yeah.
So, when that happens in the Thing prequel...
It's just the number of people.
It's just
has
a bunch
reduced.
Of people that you don't really know anything about, even though it's, you know, two-thirds of the way through the movie. Yeah. You're like, I don't know who died.
I mean, felt
the only
that
two
way
people
during Cloverfield, too. Let's talk a little about you described yourself as having strange taste.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little about other movies. You know, to illustrate this point for anybody who doesn't know, movies that this is just off the top of my head that are I'm not saying that any film is categorically good, but what I feel like is interesting about your taste is that I think you reject what is often sort of the generally held opinion, generally respected sort of a thing. Examples being like The Sixth Sense, the movie The Sixth Sense. Mm-hmm. The Breakfast Club is an example. Inglourious Basterds. We already talked about Avatar. Mm-hmm. You've said the acting on Mad Men is poor. You know,
I did not say that. I said it's uneven.
Okay, uneven.
And that might be the writing. I mean, again, I don't want to
single out actors.
I don't want to single out actors. Right. I don't want to do that.
Bridesmaids and The Town more recently, examples of movies.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you why. I mean, you're right. I hold a studio fare such as these things to a higher standard than I do a straight-to-video movie. Bridesmaids, for example, it's not a movie I disrespect. It's not a movie I loathe on any level. There are movies that are giant critical and audience successes that I so oppose to in their execution and what they actually just are.
I want to talk about Bridesmaids, but name one of those movies. I want to know.
The big example is Titanic. I mean, yeah. I thought Titanic was essentially a long-winded disaster film, a long-winded take on a 1970s disaster film like the Poseidon Adventure. But my problem being is it based on an actual horrible event?
Right.
And probably the more interesting elements of it, I mean, it's this, you know, romance between, you know, a poor kid and a rich lady, and that could have been interesting, that class, you know, in this situation where a ship is sinking and most everybody's going to die, how the classes suddenly clash with each other and they lock
which
people
they captured.
They captured, but to me, most of that movie, I mean, because it was 2 hours before you get to the actual disaster, which I think is bad pacing in a movie that you know is about a ship sinking. I get that you have to suddenly care about the characters, you know, that you're watching die, I guess, in order for it to resonate. But I don't think you need to take 2 hours to
do Titanic that. Sort of opened the floodgates of the three-hour Hollywood movie that is so common now.
Yeah, and I because of the way I think most of it was the writing, and I didn't think the effects were as great as everybody said. I thought there were a lot of really obvious computer effects, and that always takes me out of it. I mean, you know, to get back to the John Carpenter's thing versus the new thing, you have practical effects and then digital effects. Digital effects are not scary.
Right.
I mean, for me. I think practical effects, and I think a lot of that has to do with you got actors on a set actually dealing with something physical. Even if they know when they're on set, they see it and they see the puppeteers behind it, still it's physical. So they're actually working and reacting off something as opposed to nothing, or as opposed to a tennis ball at the end of a pole. You know, where it's completely up to the actor's imagination. I mean, the cool thing about movie entertainment, you know, but even, you know, any kind of plays too, but the thing I always love about movies is you can put an actor in a crazy situation with all this supernatural stuff and you can create it practically, and then the actors are actually reacting off of this monster that's in their presence. But now it's all digital effects for reasons I don't completely understand.
A little bit of it's mob mentality.
There's no reason. I mean, people love and still love John Carpenter's The Thing in a lot of cases because of the practical effects. So if you're, you know, if that's your core audience, then why are you using digital effects? I mean, I get, and with Titanic, you know, there were shots where
it's kind
you
of like in the 90s where every drama had to be shot with a super shaky camera, you know. It's kind of just groupthink rather than trying to do its best for the project.
And it's very, I mean, and I think a lot of that, you know, has to do with corporate culture, and that's the way business decisions are made. This worked, you know, last week, so we need to do it again, and as much as possible, and as long as it keeps working, they'll keep doing it. As far as, you know, making money, not as far as actually being good.
Making good products.
But, I mean, my biggest problem with the Titanic was sort of that it was handled as in the same manner that the Towering Inferno was handled, and the Poseidon Adventure, and Earthquake, which all of those movies had this melodramatic flair, but they also had like quips and stuff. And Titanic had that. Kathy Bates is watching the Titanic go down from her rich lady rowboat and says, well, there's something you don't see every day.
But she's the unsinkable Molly Brown. I mean, there's a sort of a historic precedent for that character.
I'm not saying there isn't a historic precedent for the character. What I'm saying is that line, I don't know, maybe she did utter that line. I don't know. But I don't know. There was something, it felt like exploitation to me of a real event that had, you know, the icky flavor of exploitation films that aren't based on a real event, that and which is a weird kind of thing with me, because I'll watch an exploitation
film
when I
was watching the movie
and enjoy the hell out of it if I know it's fiction.
Right.
But because this is the way he handled, you know, an actual event, you know what I mean? I mean, it's
happened to me was I kept being kind of taken out of the drama of the story because it was, like you said, a real thing, so I was a little too aware of the fact that people really went through this specific thing, and it's so meticulously recreated.
I know. I mean, it's sort of... this is, probably not a great comparison. It's probably a bit much. But, you know, imagine if one of the characters in Schindler's List watching, you know, the train taking people to Auschwitz to go into the, you know, gas houses, shower gas houses.
Yeah.
If Liam Neeson had watched the train go by and go, well, there's something you don't see.
Right.
I mean, it's just...
I had a little flavor of that with the Schindler's List, though. I remember the shower scene, the famous shower scene where Embeth Davids and all the other prisoners are ushered into this thing, and you don't know whether or not it's going to be a gas chamber and they're all about to die, or they're literally just taking a shower. In fact, we assume it's a gas chamber because we all know about that.
Right.
And then when water comes down, it's kind of like this big relief. I think it might have even music sort of surged in the soundtrack. Mm. And in that moment, I had a very similar reaction to what you're describing. It felt almost kind of sick because the Spielbergian tricks that make cinema so exciting and dramatic in an artificial way, and we get swept up in it, were being applied to this horrific moment in history.
Yeah, I agree with that criticism. I agree with that. I mean, that's Spielberg pulling punches, which he did a lot on Schindler's List.
Which he could argue that, he has to make this palatable if it's a movie that's going to get an audience and stand the test of time and everything else, I suppose. Sure. It didn't appeal to me, but I think that would be his argument.
But there should have... All I'm saying is there should have been more critics pointing that out.
Noticing
there
it.
There should have been more criticism. And I mean, there should have been more criticism of Titanic on that level. This is a real event, but then there's these, like, completely goofy moments.
Let's talk about Sixth Sense. That's
okay, Sixth Sense. Yes, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense, you know, I don't... My main problem with The Sixth Sense is it's a movie that hinges entirely on its surprise third act twist. I mean, if you see it coming, which I did within 20 minutes, you know, I saw through the tricks.
You predicted that Bruce Willis was dead.
Yeah,
sorry, spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
We'll edit spoiler alert before I said that.
At this point in you're a podcast listener.
Rosebud is a sled.
You've been putting off watching The Sixth Sense for all this time.
Yeah.
And you get what you deserve.
Oops.
But, I mean, chances are if you haven't seen The Sixth Sense, you're probably not
you're
going
not
to
interested.
See it at this point. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you can ask my wife. I ruined the film for her. She was very mad.
Interesting.
And then I almost did the same thing with The Others, which is a very similar picture.
But The Others, by that time, Hollywood movies molded in that M. Night formula were so common, I predicted the ending of The Others right away. But that's because we knew by then that was what...
I did not predict it. But I did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I saw it. I mean, to me, it was obvious. But the movie... And you know, the twist endings and spoilers, in my mind, shouldn't matter that much.
Good craft and still
if you're telling a good story and you're telling and you have compelling characters, it doesn't really matter if you know the ending. You know, if you flip to the end of the book and you read the ending, it doesn't matter that you know the ending as long as the book is exciting.
Right.
You know
absolutely.
What I mean? And if the story is exciting,
then I'm into it. But The Sixth Sense, I just thought was...
Nobody thought Star Wars, that Darth Vader was going to win, you know, at the end of the movie Star Wars.
Exactly. If you went into Empire Strikes Back knowing, you know, a week after it opened and all your friends said is his father, it's not like... You still enjoy the revelation of that in the context of that movie, even if you see it coming.
Mm-hmm.
But The Sixth Sense to me is I mean, it's a very long movie for what it is, and it's kind of a simplistic murder mystery without the twist at the end.
And that has been
done before. I mean, that everything else about that movie, if you've seen horror movies, especially haunted house movies and ghost movies. You've seen it before. I mean, it's The Changeling. It's The Haunting. There's so many of those. The ghosts are trying to tell you something, and then you figure out the murder mystery. So I'd seen that before.
Ghost was that?
Ghost was that. And I don't. I just once I could see that, you know, Bruce Willis was dead. There the rest of the mystery wasn't very compelling to me.
Let's talk about Bridesmaids.
Bridesmaids. Okay.
You didn't like it. Everyone loved it. It's the most popular movie ever made. I didn't make that up. That's what some commercial for Bridesmaids on DVD told me.
Oh, I'm
the most
sure
popular comedy in the history of celluloid, or something.
Really?
Like that. Well, they said something pretty.
That seems like an amazing claim, given it just came out a few months ago.
I think it said the most popular comedy ever.
I think you need to give it at least 20, 25 years before you can make that claim for sure.
Yeah, yes. This is more popular than Some Like It Hot. This is going to outlast.
Yeah,
because the Great Dictator.
It's bigger than Caddyshack. I mean, Caddyshack was a hated movie when it came out, and now it's beloved and pretty much everybody. Who likes comedies?
Modern comedy
has seen it.
Yeah,
you know, Bridesmaids. I mean, it's like I don't was. Did I think it was that funny? Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's what you know. And comedy is very difficult to do, I think, because it's so subjective. It's the most subjective genre there is. And I think part of the problem that I have with studio comedies in general is that they try to appeal to too many demographics at once.
Absolutely.
And then you have these massive tonal shifts, which I think Judd Apatow movies in general have massive tonal shifts. And with the 40-Year-Old Virgin, which I really liked, had massive tonal shifts, but because I'd never seen, you know, that was like the first one of its kind, I enjoyed it. But then
I don't think it took itself as seriously as the rest of his movies.
I agree with that too. It was way more goofy and it had a more absurd edge. And I feel like maybe buried underneath the 2 hours of Bridesmaids, there was a nice, 90-minute movie that was a little bit more absurd and a little bit less treacly with the lady friendships. But also, I mean, I think Kristen Wiig's really, really funny. And I'm not saying that if you pull a scene out of that movie, and I haven't seen the movie, you pull some arbitrary scene out of it, I might laugh. But after, at the halfway point of the movie, where it's still trying to have heart, and she's getting her business back together and all that stuff. And, falling in love with a cop and all that stuff, which, individually there were nice scenes in there. But she, every major event that her friend had for her wedding, she destroyed in horrible ways, like ludicrous, deal-breaking ways. I mean, the diarrhea at the restaurant, you can chalk that up to a mistake. As an audience member.
And you can say it's not really her fault.
It's her character's making a passive-aggressive choice to take her friend who's got a lot of money to a place that she can afford.
Right.
Which is fine.
Right.
But so that one I could let slide. And I thought a lot of it was funny. I mean, like a bunch of people getting horrible diarrhea at once is really funny. Although I thought the scene ultimately went on too long. So by the time Maya Rudolph is shitting in the street, I was like, no, this is a little bit ridiculous because the tone that they're coming from is a more real tone, and then it goes over the top. Whereas if tonally you let me know from the get-go, this is a goofy comedy, whereas it's going back and forth. So it wants me to have these emotional, very, you know, emotional connections where I could wind up crying about friendships falling apart.
Right.
What in between gales of laughter. I can't go there.
What's funny is that I had the opposite reaction to that movie, which is that the trailers and the clips I saw didn't make me laugh. And somehow the whole was more effective to me than the individual parts I was exposed to. I didn't feel like the injection of the relationship stuff between the characters was so much an attempt at heart as much as just kind of like it grounded the story in something relatable and therefore made it more funny and more compelling for me.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, just for me, in fact, for me, part of the problem was even though, you know, they had these grounded, relatable moments, but then they had so many moments that were not grounded and completely unrelatable.
Mm-hmm.
And they all centered around Wig's character. And she was destroying her friends, best friends, every party she threw, she would destroy it.
Yeah, but selfishly. That's comedy. I mean,
yeah, that's comedy. But
selfishly or accidentally.
But they never.
Ways.
But
she didn't intend to get overdose on.
Yeah, but you can't. You can't.
Plane.
But it's the cake and eat it too thing. I mean, it's like the restaurant thing was okay,
right?
And then what? Like then she just selfishly destroys party after party, and I'm just not at a certain point. I'm just not buying that there's a friendship here anymore. This movie should have become about a woman who has, you know, pushed everyone out of her life and is now alone. And wherever that goes is fine. But if you want me to take something on a relatable level, on a realistic level, then you have to go down those. You can't do both. You can't have your happy ending and your friends making up after those events. I don't buy it.
But you didn't feel the use of Wilson Phillips made it relatable for you? His music in the...
No. I love Wilson Phillips.
All right.
Particularly their cover
Do you
album.
Think... Let me ask you this serious question. Do you think that it's the rise of kind of interest in improv comedy over the last 20 years that has kind of screwed up the pacing of comedies?
I think it can. Again, I think it's a choice. And that's not getting made. Especially with... I mean, Apatow and there's so many... But there are movies that are Apatow-esque... that don't have these tonal shifts. For example, because I feel like we're just being negative about it. For example, you know, the movie Role Models was, you know, had a lot of those kind of the same actors as Apatow movies, the same kind of vibe of the comedy. But, they're, you know, it's a 90-minute movie or an hour, 40 minutes, and it doesn't have those tonal shifts. I mean, it does have a little bit of heart, but it doesn't have too much of it. You know, and I mean, I thought I Love You Man, too, was funny. And it had that bromance and, you know, relatable elements to it. But it was also, you know, had a very specific comic tone throughout. And it didn't do too much to pull at your heartstrings and, you know, all that stuff that I thought, you know, Bridesmaids had. I thought Knocked Up had a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the comedy comes out of all these improvs that the actors are doing, but then the filmmakers feel beholden to all these, you know, tropes of romantic comedies or whatever.
Right.
So you really have two movies jammed into one, and then you have these massive tonal shifts. And so I would say, yeah, but also I think, I mean, Caddyshack is always a go-to example,
right,
that they threw out most of the script in favor of the improv.
They only try to be funny.
You have to choose.
Right.
If you're making an improv-y show, then you have to choose that. You can't do that and then cut it in with the scripted stuff as well. Because then you just have a bloated movie that's, for me anyway, with the tonal shifts, make it hard to enjoy.
I get your point. I feel, I guess over the years, my impression of your taste in movies has... And this, I want to ask you if this is right or if maybe I'm wrong, is that what has bothered me about it,
mm-hmm,
is the sense that that? That is somebody calling? A phone call. Yes, that's...
Do you always have answer phones?
I really don't want to stop, yeah, my getting calls just for my radio show.
All right.
So if you could just... You know what? Just quickly talk about Inglourious Basterds.
Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, I'll be right there. I'll be back in a minute. Just make it really interesting.
All right. All right, this is really weird. I've never been abandoned by the host of a podcast before. I'm Inglourious Basterds. I've actually seen it twice, because often I will go back and look at a movie that I wasn't fond of the first time, if they are very popular. I've seen Titanic twice as well, just to see if maybe... because I often go back and there's a movie I didn't like, and I'll go back and I'll say, oh my, that's quite more entertaining than I remember it. But in the case of Inglourious Basterds, I mean, I thought, you know, it wasn't my thing. I really love the opening sequence. It's very terrifying, with the Christopher White's being kind of a CSI Nazi who...
Christoph Waltz?
Christoph Waltz, is that his name? I like that. I really like the opening sequence of that movie, and then the rest of the movie... I thought it was Tarantino's got a bag of tricks, like every other filmmaker, and his bag of tricks. Welcome back. Did everything work out in the garden?
We're good. Yeah.
Okay.
We're out of paint.
Oh, yeah.
Just so you listeners know, they're building a fence around my garden, and they ran out of white paint. So when I'm done interviewing Todd, I'm gonna have to go pick some up. So yeah. I please finish your point, and then I'll get to those.
Yeah, I mean, basically, Inglourious Basterds. The other thing is Inglourious Basterds is because Tarantino riffs on other older movies that he loves,
right?
And I think that's paying homage is fun, mm-hmm. but only if you're sort of yes-anding it, which is the improvisational thing is a yes-and. I like that, and I'll add this to it. And I think that's just basically artistic evolution, and I like that. And I felt that with Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, he did that, but then he added, you know, modern spins to it, and he played with tropes and he changed them around. So, you know, because, you know, he's doing a crime movie and you're used to certain crime movie tropes, and then suddenly, you know, two hitmen are talking about arbitrary things before they go in and blow people away, which is something you hadn't seen before, was a lot of fun. I also thought Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction of all of his movies were the tightest.
Well, they had better stories.
There were better stories, and they were more tightly produced.
He could have these little satellites orbiting around the main story because the main story was really strong. And
right.
That's, to me, the big difference between those two movies, right, and the rest of his career.
I agree. I mean, I've revisited all of his movies because I know there's so many Tarantino fans and apologists and all that.
Sure. And you are a film critic on the other podcast.
I have the Film Pigs podcast. Yes,
Film
that's
Pigs
true.
Podcast. In addition to being a constant guest, being constantly interviewed on podcasts.
Yeah, I do a lot of podcasts. It's most of my time.
Yeah.
It's the only one who bests me in this realm really is Patton Oswalt,
right,
at this point. He guests on... I'm sure you've had him on your show before.
This is actually the first episode of my show.
Oh, really? This is the inaugural episode.
Inaugural episode of Toncast.
So weird.
By Francis,
you know, there's a couple other Toncasts out there.
Really?
Just so you know. I mean, I've been interviewed by other people who have a podcast called Toncast. It's
a
very popular name. It's very strange. Anyway, Inglourious Basterds, you know, I just after that opening sequence, which was great. I mean, I really loved it.
It was very tense. It reminded me of Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Yeah.
And because I'm a fan, as Quentin Tarantino obviously is, of Inglourious Basterds,
which is an Italian
exploitation film ripoff of Dirty Dozen. It's a highly entertaining, very goofy film. But the Inglourious Basterds, the Dirty Dozen, I mean, that's what it is a Dirty Dozen ripoff movie. Kelly's Heroes, you know, those kind of movies. And it focuses on their journey.
And Inglourious Basterds has that crew that, and then in the trailers, it's like, we're going to scalp some Nazis or however mm-hmm. Brad Pitt was talking. Nazis. I was like, awesome!
Yeah.
This is a movie about, you know, like the original, about these guys going, I mean, it's, his take is, you know, scalping Nazis. I was like, fabulous. But there's so little of that in that movie. And so much of people in bars talking before, and whereas in Pulp Fiction, you know, it's taught when you see the hitmen step up. Oh, it's not time yet. Mm-hmm. It, you know, and it's taught, and because you know, but, you know, and he's playing with that tension. Whereas in the big, long bar scene, it was way too long. I mean, it was way too long, and it was talking, and it was supposed, but after a certain point, I was just like, let's get to the gunfight.
Well, everybody in that bar scene was a minor character of the story that we'd been introduced to.
Right.
So it was confusing.
Right.
Because it was sort of a, well, it was a convoluted storyline. But, yeah, so what I was going to say when we were so rudely interrupted, and actually, Tarantino's a good example of this, which is, I have often felt that you're that you prefer movies
mm-hmm.
that don't really try to be good,
mm-hmm.
whereas you may be, in my mind, unfairly critical of movies that aspire to do something more, that kind of have a higher bar they're trying to set, they're trying to reach.
I see what you're saying.
And the reason I mentioned Tarantino is a good example, maybe, is the Kill Bill Volume 1 versus Kill Bill Volume 2.
I see.
You liked Kill Bill Volume 1, did sure. not like 2.
Well, I like parts of 2.
Parts of 2, but you felt that...
But I didn't like
I remember Carradine's, us having this discussion. Yeah. You didn't... I think you felt 2 was too long and meandering and character-driven type of thing, and that was what was intriguing to me about 2 after the first one being purely chop-socky sort of action, and the whole movie's, you know, you could... There's other flaws you could talk about, but that I do remember us having the opposite reaction at the time the movies
mm-hmm,
came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I liked the character development, and you kind of just wanted action.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, I do... And people have told me before that this isn't fair as of me as a movie
as
lover
a viewer.
And a movie critic. But I'm not a critic. I'm not a professional critic. Professional critics get paid to go to movies, and they don't pay for movies. I pay for movies. I'm a movie lover. I'm a movie junkie. You know, but
I see your point.
I'm not being pretentious about it. These are my visceral reactions to movies. I'm not, you know, but I'm also not, you know, an internet hater. I'm not, you know, like so many people on the internet are, you know, or you follow them on Twitter or whatever. And I just watched this and everybody involved in it is a shithead, you know, or whatever, or homophobic slurs or whatever people like to do. And I'm not that either. I mean, I do hold movies to their marketing campaigns,
mm-hmm.
Which Inglourious Basterds didn't live up to.
Oh my gosh, it was incredibly deceiving.
Yeah, and I thought Drive was very conceiving.
Right, that's another example of a highly celebrated movie that you.
Right,
I haven't seen it, but that's what I, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I still listen to podcasts with, you know, film guys and more, you know, thoughtful critics than myself talking about why they liked it. And a lot of them sort of accuse this is Drive. What were we talking about before?
We were talking about Inglourious Basterds, and we were talking about the Kill Bill 1 to 2.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, but Kill Bill Volume 1 did live up to its marketing promise, whereas mm-hmm. Kill Bill Volume 2 did not. Because also, I mean, Tarantino was saying, I want this to be, this is my homage to the action genre.
Right.
You know, and Kill Bill Volume 2 had maybe one action scene in it, and then a lot of yammering.
It has, Kill Bill, I just saw these movies again, and Kill Bill Volume 2, if I remember correctly, nobody gets killed in that movie until David Carradine dies at the end.
No, Daryl Hannah gets
She doesn't get killed.
Oh,
she gets her eye pulled out, and then she just kind of disappears. And at the end of the movie, there's a question mark over what happened to her character.
Oh, right. I forgot.
Oh, no. Michael Madsen gets killed.
Michael Madsen gets
killed. So in that same scene. So that's it. One death
right.
before the climax. It's bizarre.
Well, I mean,
and he never intended it to be two different movies, but I've watched it as one movie at the New Beverly. It does not fucking work as one movie. It's ridiculous.
It's way too long. Yeah.
And they do an intermission right where the movies were in broke up anyway.
You know, and I'm a guy who really wants to like Tarantino more than I wind up liking his movie. I mean, I own all of his movies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's obviously something about it, what he does. I mean, and like I say, Inglourious Basterds has a couple of great scenes in there. And Jackie Brown has a bunch of really good scenes in there. But after Pulp Fiction, I think his movies became there's a little bit too much self-indulgence in there.
And so I can understand not liking self-indulgence. And Kill Bill's not the best example, but it was the first one I could think of because of that parallel.
Mm-hmm.
Is, do you feel like you reject or you really are inclined to reject movies that are more ambitious? I've heard you criticize a movie for... now, I understand your opinion about the tonal shifts of a comedy that drags because it's trying to be dramatic in places. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a movie that, for example, tries to balance two genres in a sort of innovative way is something that I would celebrate. So I wouldn't automatically criticize a film for defying its genre expectations.
No, neither would I. I mean, I like a good mashup movie. I don't think Bridesmaids is a good example.
No, that's not an example.
I have no problem with that. That's a different thing. But you can mash two genres, but then your whole piece is totally consistent just because you have two genres in there.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that it can't be tonally consistent.
Well, like Something Wild's a good example. I don't know if you've seen that film of a movie.
I like that movie, and you liked that
worked for you, that kind of a...
Yeah, but that movie doesn't have massive tonal shifts in it.
Well, it has one.
What is the tonal shift?
It's kind of a lighthearted... Yeah, I know. It's kind of a lighthearted comedic road movie until Ray Liotta's character comes in, and then it's really menacing for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. That is... Or like a From Dusk Till Dawn.
Sure, that's a later or more recent example.
Which I liked. I mean, I think that movie's sort of bananas, but
that's a very good example.
It's
of
also,
what we're talking
I mean,
about.
From Dusk Till Dawn.
Because it's a risk taking sort of, story. Yeah.
But it's also an unapologetic B movie.
Right.
I mean, so that's more up my alley. But,
true.
But even though the genre shift and everything changes and it gets wonky,
mm-hmm.
the characters are totally consistent the entire time. And it's been too long for me to really talk about that tonal shift in Something Wild, but now that you mention it, I remember it. But also, I mean, the character, Melanie Griffith, she's a weird woman.
Right.
That he is, and he's like correct me if I'm wrong, but he's sort of a middle American
guy. He's very ordinary.
And
yeah.
It's sort of a midlife crisis thing,
right.
And he gets hooked up with this chick, and he's having a great time with this chick. The movie, you know, the story's tone might shift from lighthearted romantic thing to suddenly this is a terror show. But that the consistency of Melanie Griffith's character,
and it's true, like, to the setup, because
the
anybody
setup
with common sense would know that could go there.
And I mean, and that when you're doing a huge genre shift like that,
right?
There's a very specific place where that happens versus a movie like Knocked Up and a movie like Bridesmaids. It's shifting back and forth, and it's asking you to constantly change, you know, what you're feeling and how you're perceiving things. Whereas Something Wild, even though it, you know, the story changes so dramatically, it doesn't shift back and forth. It's also not really a movie that's playing on the more the more treacly side of movie.
No, I mean, it's not trying to make you have that kind of emotional reaction. It's better crafted, but you know, and maybe my impression has been inaccurate. You know, you name Knocked Up, which tries to be something more than just
there was a lot of stuff in Knocked Up that I liked,
yeah.
But it's too long.
But it's not the stuff where it tried to be more.
Right.
It's the stuff where it was consistent with its presentation as kind of a silly comedy.
Right.
And ditto for Kill Bill. You like Kill Bill best when people are getting killed and not when it tries to be character-based and dramatic.
Well, right, but also there's... I mean, it's I don't think, like, at least not for me. I mean, again, this is all subjective.
Right.
As all criticism is. I mean, no matter how versed you are in, you know, cinema history and cinema in general and the way... It's all ultimately subjective.
Of course.
Because there's no scientific measurements. You know, there's no way of saying, you know, this actor is a terrible actor and here's the scientific proof. It's just... It's all ultimately subjective.
That's part of what's... To me, so maybe fascinating and a little unnerving about our business.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, everything we do is subject to that.
Yeah, and it's. I think that
it's all perceived value.
When you boil it down, that everybody, no matter what facet they're in, of the creative thing. But you know, it's true about. But it's true about, you know, the art department. It's true about, you know, the lighting department. I mean, anybody who's got any kind of creative impulses, and they're creating this fictional world out of, you know, nothing. Everybody's got a little voice,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know, directors wind up having the biggest voices, and actors wind up having the biggest voices. At least our perception is, but everybody wants their voice to be acknowledged by everybody. Maybe not loved, but taken, you know, seriously, and, you know, and everybody
as widely accepted as possible.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that, I mean, I think the difference between, you know, the people always use the phrase selling out, which I think is a really dumb phrase, but when you have an artist,
overused too.
Yeah, it's overused, and I don't think it's really, it doesn't really work in today's culture. I mean, until, you know, we start regulating corporations again, then maybe you can start having those sellout arguments. But there's no way of making money in today's society without coupling yourself with some corporate entity somewhere. It's impossible. I mean, yeah,
that's true.
You could start a commune, I guess, but then, you know, then you're just in a commune. Then you never leave.
I just saw Martha Marcy May Marlene last night about the... It's a movie about a cult.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah. It definitely makes you sensitive to anybody who seems like they're trying to, yeah, dictate what other people do. I was in my yoga class the next night, like, thinking, why does this teacher think she can tell us what to do? Because that movie freaks you out, because John Hawks plays the cult leader, and he's just so kind of like, they do everything he says.
Yeah, I heard that movie was pretty good. I've heard that on podcasts. People saw it in film festivals and stuff. So I look forward to seeing it. But uniformly everybody said, this is a really good movie.
Right.
But I don't ever want to see it again.
I can understand that. The funny thing about that movie, and I don't want to get away from your point, my impression of Martha Marcy was it's more of a drama.
Mm-hmm.
They call it a psychological horror film, but to me, a horror film is something where you relate to the victim, so you're scared for the person.
Right.
And the main character's not relatable in Martha Marcy. She's been brainwashed. And so she's as alienating as the other characters in the movie.
Right.
And it makes an interesting film to watch, but I didn't find it maybe as upsetting as some of the reactions I've read online. I just found it an interesting and probably really accurate insight into what it would be like for someone trying to detox, trying to adjust back to normal life after they've been in a cult.
Yeah.
But you were talking about corporations, about the idea of selling out, and particularly, I think we're getting back to this idea of directors ambitiously trying to appeal to the greatest.
Right. And I think that if there is
audience,
a version of selling out, then when you're compromising your own artistic voice for a more corporate audience.
So that's how you... That can't be how you see the Kill Bill.
No. I mean, I think that's why I own all of Tarantino's movies, even though I don't really like most of them as a whole, is because he becomes very self-indulgent quite a bit, I think, as a filmmaker. But at the same time, his self-indulgence is his own.
He's indulging himself.
His own voice. To me, I'd rather watch those kind of failures than something that's so atrociously bland.
I get that completely. So it's not, you don't actually have a problem with directors or artists being super ambitious No. Your criticism sounds to me like what you're saying is directed more at something that is crafted to try and make more money in the corporation's mind
and
get a bigger audience maybe in the artist's
right.
mind. Maybe.
But you're saying that I am more likely to be critical of, you know, movies that are aspiring to something else.
Yeah.
But I also
think... That was always what my impression was. I think it's interesting to hear you spell it out.
That's interesting. I'm not saying that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
I do think I hold movies that have more money behind them to a higher, I forgive less.
Yeah.
I particularly forgive less, you know, if the movie is, you know, asking me to take it hugely seriously and it's very important and when people, you know, when people, it's like Tarantino needs more people, and I think this is true about Spielberg too. I love these filmmakers, and that's why I'm critical of them, because there aren't enough people. I don't think there are enough people in their lives going, you know what, this, I get what you're going here for here, but this, that's not really, that's a little self-indulgent, don't you think?
Right. I mean, Inglourious Bastards was kind of a train wreck, and it was nominated for an Oscar.
But that's what
I'm
saying.
And so you could say, what, you know, I understand that. I think that's fair. I get that. That's interesting. And everybody has their prejudice. Everybody has their tendencies, obviously, mm-hmm. and that's totally cool. Our friend Steven has accused me of affirmative action for independent films. And it's the same sort of thing. He thinks I have a bias. I'll be more forgiving for what... Yes, I'll be more forgiving for an independent film than I am of a studio film.
Okay, this is a good thing to talk about. So I think that everybody has that genre of film,
mm-hmm.
you know, or a couple... You know, where they're more forgiving. Where you would rather watch... You, Frank, would rather watch a bad indie movie than a bad studio picture.
And even to put it more bluntly, I think I would probably be less likely to consider that indie movie bad.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like you, I think in this regard we're the same, I'm a lot more likely to think the studio film is bad. You know, and I'll see an indie film that objectively, as objective as this business could be, many people think is horrendous, and I won't have nearly as negative reaction as I did to Transformers Dark of the Moon, which I walked out of, you know?
Right, right. Well, yeah, I mean, but indie films generally don't have that level of bombast that...
Well, okay, yeah, unpleasantness aside, it's true that the bias, I think, goes literally to take.
But, I mean,
it's not even a conscious choice.
I think people are... And this is not a judgment, because a lot of the podcasts I listen to, because my opinions are different than them, listen to Slash Filmcast, which is, you know, I think it's a fun podcast, and they're smart
Slash
guys.
Slash has a film cast?
No, it's just Slash Filmcast.
I gotcha.
There's a Slash.
Yeah.
Slash has nothing to
it's
do
not
with
Slash.
It. I would love to listen to
that would be interesting.
Slash's Filmcast.
Right.
I would be a regular listener of that. But, these guys are just movie geeks. But they cream over Drive, and they're like, well, you know, American audiences, they go and they need it loud, and it's not a lot of talking, they can't do it. And I'm like, well, that's so dismissive of anybody who has a different opinion than you. And I don't dismiss anyone for liking Drive. I don't think Drive is an incompetent movie. It's just not for me. And does that mean that because they're like, well, they want to see Thor in Fast Five. And, Thor, I thought, was a mediocre superhero movie, and Fast Five was loud and really stupid. But I can also go to art house films and see potboiler thrillers and all kinds of genres and enjoy them. It's just I didn't like Drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought,
you know, for
funny enough, they're adopting the attitude that I feel the studios have, which is exactly the problem, which is this very low expectation of their audience.
Right.
Therefore, they put out movies like Transformers and Thor and what's the
and
other one? Fast Five.
They're, I mean, this...
And then they market them. They spend as much on marketing or more than they do on the film. And lo and behold, the films get seen. Well, that's because a large portion of the audience really doesn't even know about other options.
Right.
Or if they do... it's the loudest voice. It's just like McDonald's versus the tiny little amount of money that the government has put aside to encourage us to eat healthy.
Right. Yeah, right. Exactly. And in the case of Drive, it's... I don't just want bombastic entertainment. But Drive, for me, was... it was a little student filmy. I mean, there's an entire fight sequence, you know, that's shot completely as shadows on a parking lot, you know.
Gotcha.
And they're saying, well, you didn't, you know, you, the audience that doesn't like Drive obviously didn't pick up on the subtleties of the why he's wearing a scorpion jacket, but I picked up on all that stuff. Yeah. I just didn't care, you know. And they're like, well, it's great how he's stoic and almost wooden in his performance, whereas, you know, a lot of... you know, a different movie... If this movie had come out at a different time, I wonder if they would have been so on board. If all the movies...
You mean if it wasn't set against this background
of... It came after the summertime.
Yeah, summer.
It came after the summertime, movies. And they're calling it... Well, the audiences just can't deal with anything original. Yes, they can.
Yeah.
Maybe you're not giving them enough credit. Maybe the reason why people aren't going to Drive is people heard what Drive is, and they don't want to see it, because it's not original. It's a throwback to 80s, and does it add much to a Michael Mann 80s film? Not really. Not really.
Do you think you come off on the Film Pigs podcast as cynical?
Yeah, I mean, everybody thinks I'm a cynic, yeah.
Do you think you're a cynic? Would you call yourself cynical?
I don't think so. I'm somewhat jaded, sure. Cynicism suggests something that I don't think I am. I mean, I don't really care. If you think I'm cynical, that's fine. And maybe I am, maybe I am. But cynics seem to me like the kind... If you're truly cynical, then you wouldn't go to the movies at all.
Right.
If I was truly cynical, we wouldn't be having this conversation. A cynic's like...
That's right. You would have given up.
True cynicism leads to true apathy.
Right.
And I'm neither of those things, I don't think. I mean, if I have an opinion and I actually want to talk to you about it, that means that, you know, I care enough about your opinion and enough about my opinion to, like, have a debate about it.
Right.
And I'm not beyond having my mind changed. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about Bridesmaids. I'll look at Bridesmaids again on video. I was saying while you were out of the room to the audience that I've gone back and looked at movies that I didn't like the first time at home in a mm-hmm. different setting, and I found them much more amusing. And when you get the initial disappointment,
like Titanic,
way,
was it more
no,
music?
No, I went back and I looked at Titanic again, and no, I still don't like Titanic. But I will go back and look at Drive again. And
yeah.
Who knows? And I've watched Inglourious Basterds twice, and I don't like Inglourious Basterds. I don't think it works. But I have gone back to and looked at other movies, comedies, and all different kinds, and gone back and go, oh yeah, no, I see what I was missing when I was there.
I know what you mean about being dismissive, though, of people who don't have the same opinion as you. I think that's such a human nature sort of compulsion, and I like that about you, that I don't think you have that. That's why it's a pleasure still to talk to you about movies, even when it can be infuriating.
Well, but also, I mean, we've known each other for so long.
Right.
And, I mean, it's like Hicks and all that stuff, and you know, it's a first impression thing. I mean, when we were in college and when we first moved out to L.A., sort of, you know, not as a literal group, but all at
all
similar
times.
I was much more aggravated when people didn't agree with me. But I was young. I mean, I don't think, you know, until you're over 25, even over 30, you kind of realize, oh, wait a second.
Right.
You know, and also, you know, a lot of those conversations happen over several drinks. So you're, you know, when you get drunk, you just get blah, 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 you know, and it's all just a bunch of nonsense. But I mean, I've also... you know, changed a lot. I don't think my opinions have changed, but the way I voice them has changed a lot. Am I cynical? No, I mean, because I think the film
takes... Do you think you're more cynical now than you were when you were younger? Or do you think you're less cynical now?
I don't think I'm more or less... I don't think I've ever been cynical. Mm-hmm. I think I'm...
Yeah, you actually
I'm,
don't.
I think I'm less angry.
Okay.
Am I not angry? No.
No.
I'm angry and you know, and I could be angry at the general population quite a bit for the decisions we make as a society. It, you know, it's not just movies. I'm still mad. I think if you're not angry or frustrated or confused or depressed on some level, you know, then you're just not paying attention to anything. You know what I mean?
I agree with that.
I mean, that's what life is. I mean, I think too, you know, as a culture, everybody's taking so many pills to stop being depressed. It's like, well, wait a sec, let's look at that. I mean, is it just that everybody's chemically imbalanced and we've started evolving into crazy people, or is it that there's something wrong and people who have a slight chemical imbalance tend to go, you know, spiral downward? But what is causing that? I mean, depression doesn't happen in a vacuum. Enough happens to you, and the world does enough stuff to you that's where you go. And you know, the movies.
And that's one thing that's always been consistent about you is that your anger, yeah, maybe has. I wouldn't say it's subsided. I'd maybe say that you've matured in how you handle it. But you've been observing and questioning. Yeah. Everything around you, and I admire that.
And I'm naturally deconstructionist, and I think that's why when you talk about the horror genre and the action genre and B-movies of the past and straight-to-video movies of today, I mean, most of them, I you know, freely admit, you know, are junk, but terrible. Unwatchable. People shouldn't watch these things.
Right.
Like Steven Seagal straight-to-video movies. Nobody should ever watch those.
Well, let's do this, though, because you have... Let's end on a positive note here. Mm-hmm. Give us three. This is you're the expert. So tell us what
three
of those movies we should see.
Steven Seagal movies?
No. Well,
you mean straight to video or
all of those
B
genres
movies?
That are the ones that you are a connoisseur of? B movies, whether you're talking about horror, whether you're talking about action.
Well, I mean, it's hard to make that recommendation because if you don't like the genre of horror or action, if you don't like it.
You're not speaking to that audience. You're just speaking to people who haven't seen them yet. I like all those genres when they're good. That's the funny thing is that I'm not much of a genre fan in any category. I think of myself, at least, as liking movies that are good.
All right, here's a recent movie, and I'm pretty sure it got a theatrical release over in the UK because it's, you know, it's one of those UK movies. But it's called... the Dog House, or just Dog House, and it's kind of a zombie. I don't know if they're vampires or zombies. It's become very blurry.
Okay.
Because there's like the, you know, they're crazy zombie-esque vampires if they're vampires.
They're undead that feast
but
on
it's
people.
A, it's a very inappropriate film, and it's very gross, and the lead characters are essentially all kind of assholes, and one of them's just... sort of comes, you know, his arc, you know, ultimately is realizing, Jesus Christ, all my friends are assholes. but they go to a town to get laid, and the town is was renowned for being full of women, but when they get there, the women aren't women anymore.
Got it.
Very amusing picture. So that's a newer movie that I would recommend watching.
Dog House.
Older, B movies that I love that, you know, guilty pleasure. I don't know about that phrase, but
yeah, I would think it would have no meaning when we're talking about.
Yeah, it's
you're turning everything on its ear because that's the genres you like best.
Yes, that's true. That's true. The guilty genres, I guess. But that could have been my Catholic upbringing. But also, you know,
I think you would have felt guilty if you liked Titanic because it was a big Hollywood product.
Well, I have. I mean, it's like I liked Dolphin Tale, and that's a really cheesy, trickly movie that, you know, in principle I should hate, but I liked it. But I think it was well executed, and it was, you know, the kids were good, and that's a huge thing. If your little kid actors in your little kid movie are good, that it makes really all the difference. But another B movie, I'm trying to go back to like
80s or to, 70s.
To, yeah, or the 70s.
Okay.
I really like Coffee with Pam Grier.
Oh, sure.
That's a great a blaxploitation film.
That's the Pam Grier movie you'd recommend if someone wanted to...
That's the one that I would... If you're going to watch one Pam Grier movie, right. I would make it Coffee. I mean, I think there are a lot of fun ones, but, you know... And they're bad movies. I mean, it's not... They're done on the cheap, and the acting's not great, but I have a good time with it. But they also go places. These movies that are lower budgeted... And the B movies, they go places that the mainstream fare still doesn't really go today. And that, to me, if you're pushing the envelope and you're being irreverent, like, I respond to irreverence. And I think a lot of exploitation films and B movies and lower budgeted movies and indie movies too can be irreverent. And to me, you know, that's, I'm going to respond to that. I'll say another movie, this is more of an indie movie than a B movie, that didn't get any theatrical release back in the early 90s, and I wound up seeing it on PBS, because PBS picked up the rights, because it's based on a novel, revered novel called The Music of Chance.
Okay.
And the movie's called The Music of Chance, it's got James Spader and Mandy Patinkin. And Charles Durning, Joel Grey, Chris Penn.
Sounds like a great cast.
It's a great cast. A lot of people, you know, think it's dull or whatever. I love it. I mean, I love it. It's
Is that Paul Auster, The Music of Chance?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's one of my favorite movies. And I think a lot of people, it didn't gain traction because, you know, the novel... I saw the movie before the novel, and I read the novel. I really like the novel. But I think, you know, because it's a movie of this... beloved novel, that it didn't, you know, click with the people who read the novel, and it was such a small movie that, you know, they just, the studio wouldn't know what to do with it, because it's about two guys building a wall under duress. It's very creepy. It's actually very creepy. I loved it. I would recommend seeing that movie. And you have to, you can't, there's no DVD. You have to go find your own VHS copy.
Wow, interesting. All right. Well, that concludes the inaugural episode of the Tomcast, hosted by Francis Stokes. I hope to do many more. We'll see how that works out.
All right.
But thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Todd. Take care.
All right.